Hi there, welcome to the latest edition of The Front Page. You join us hot on the heels from a spectacular Guineas weekend at Newmarket. A 2,000 Guineas fit for a king, thanks to the victory of Frankie Dettori, and a 1,000 Guineas won by two comeback kings in Oisin Murphy and Saeed Bin Saroor. Talking of comebacks, the former chief executive of the Professional Jockeys Association could be its next chief executive, with Paul Struthers in line to return to the trade body after a coup was mounted by jockeys against their own trade association. We'll be looking back or looking at that, and we'll also be looking at the latest fallout from the gambling white paper. As you watch, we will be delighted if you would like, comment, share and subscribe, as the two people to my left have been doing on a regular basis. Catherine McRae and Jonathan Harding. Catherine, where are we watching the Guineas weekend from?
From the office, actually. So I've been here over the weekend. Not quite the thrill of Newmarket. But
putting in stunning service.
Of course.
And Mr. Harding, what about yourself?
Yeah, I was watching on from home. I enjoyed seeing the reporters getting quite wet, actually, in a sort of sadistic way. I had a cup of tea and it was almost too warm in my flat, but it was nice and good result.
I've had so much wet hair in the last few days. On Friday, I was on top of a big hill in the Peak District, getting very wet indeed. And then on Saturday, I got very wet in Newmarket. But the sun shone yesterday, which was lovely. Also lovely is the Racing Post Members Club, and we have a stunning offer for you on that. Okay, our first story this week is Guineas Weekend at Newmarket. Both classics produce really strong, interesting stories, as Catherine McRae will tell us.
Yes, as in our line of work, we're always looking for good stories to come out of weekends like the Guineas meeting, and we got one thanks mostly to the two riders on board, the classic winners. On Saturday, we had Frankie Dettori and what is his swan song season, get victory on Chaldean for Judmont and Andrew Balding, just 2 weeks after hitting the turf quite unceremoniously at Newbury. And then on Sunday we had Oisin Murphy, who is still under 2 months from returning from his 14-month ban, back in the limelight again with his first British Group 1 since his return. And I think you'd be hard to find any two jockeys coming into this flat season that have more that they want to prove. And it's really fitting that perhaps the two biggest names in our sport were the ones to come out on top at the Guineas weekend. A really good message for the sport to have these iconic figures back on the leading stage, I think. And it was really rewarding to see that these two jockeys, who are clearly really wanting to make a statement this season, come out so early and do that. I know you were there for both days. What was the reception like? I'd love to...
Yeah, we're very positive indeed. So, I mean, Saturday, whenever Frankie Dettori wins a big race, you get a positive reception. Mm. He still is undoubtedly the individual who most punters and racing fans connect with most. He was also backing horse, had been well backed through the day, with the ground having come in his favour. But I thought what was interesting was, there were clearly mixed emotions within Dettori on Saturday afternoon. You could see as he came into the winner's enclosure that there was a slight wobble there, and you just wondered, is he about to crack? And, you know, are we going to get some tears? And then he composed himself. But he did say his emotions were all over the place. Didn't know whether to laugh or cry. Laugh because he'd won a 2,000 guineas. Cry because he'd just gone through his last chance of riding in the 2,000 guineas. But I thought it was a really positive outcome for the sport. An hour and a quarter earlier, we'd almost had an incredibly positive outcome for the sport, because Dettori was riding Saga in the Suffolk Stakes, in the King's colours, on the day of the coronation. Who knows what were they watching at Buckingham Palace. That was the film Matilda on ITV at the same time. I'm sure they were watching that, hopefully watching it anyway. And I know behind me, I had members of the Jockey Club's communications team who were roaring home saga because they would have known that a picture of Frankie doing a flying dismount in the King's colours on Coronation Day would have made it onto the evening news bulletins, onto newspaper pages the following day. That wasn't to happen. But I think Frankie was great on Chaldean. And also, John, the horse produced a top draw performance as well, given you think he was so active as a two-year-old. His reappearance at Newbury hadn't gone according to plan because he dumped Frankie at the start. So maybe he might not have been 100% wound up, but he produced a fantastic performance.
No, he absolutely did. And the guessing game going into the Guineas is how these horses have trained on from 2 to 3 and which bit of juvenile form you put the most weight on. And it turns out the obvious answer was the Dewhurst. It was there staring at us the entire time, but we slightly all got carried away with August Rodin, quite understandably. It was a magnificent performance, really. It's a really long stride. Frankie got the fractions absolutely spot on, although I don't think he was too flustered at any point. The horse just kept going and going. I think he's an out-and-out miler, would be my thoughts. I can see maybe they might step him up for the Jubmont, given the ownership, given the pedigree. But looking at it, it's going to be interesting to see him at Royal Ascot next time. Maybe the Sussex Stakes, but he's beaten some seriously good horses there. I think a few probably didn't give their running. I think the ground did for a couple of others. We have that usual situation where some are going to go markedly up in trip and some are probably going to go the other way. There's a couple of sprinters in there that didn't disgrace themselves. But Royal Scotsman's a decent yardstick, given the Dewhurst form. And as well as the second, of course, he ran brilliantly from the front. So it looked like the form is going to be boosted as the season goes on. And I think Chaldean is... he's the one who has nothing to prove now, really. So
I think that's what I think. I think Royal Scotsman's a good name to bring out because I thought he, not an unlucky loser in the sense that he was very keen early on and he pulled hard, and that's nobody else's fault, that's the horse doing that. But he finished off the race very strongly, and I just wonder if he is still a Group 1 winner waiting to happen. I wouldn't even mind seeing him drop back to 6 furlongs for the Commonwealth Cup because I think he's got tons of toe. Wasn't a good classic for Aidan O'Brien. August Rodin was ultimately a well-backed favourite, having bizarrely drifted through the morning, even though ground conditions were coming in his favour. But he and Little Big Bear were both out the back. Odd little stat, Aidan O'Brien has now gone 4 years, 4 runnings, without a 2,000 guineas win. That's never happened in his career before. There's never been a 4-race gap between guineas successes. And at Leopardstown yesterday, his colts disappointed in the Derby trial there. So not a great classic weekend for Aidan O'Brien, because Meditate was also ultimately well beaten in the 1,000 guineas. In fact, they were all well beaten apart from 2 fillies, because Morge and Tahira pulled right away 7.5 lengths clear of the rest. As a piece of form, Catherine, that was probably a stronger piece of form than the 2,000 guineas in some ways. But again, although you had 2 wonderful fillies finishing first and second, it was a story of the people involved. You reference Ashin Murphy,
yes,
and we'll talk about him. But also Saeed Bin Sarur, who for when I was growing up, when I was a kid or a young man, he was Mr. Godolphin as a trainer. You know, he had all their best horses, going right back to Balanchine and Lamtara, horses like that, but Lamtara in the 1995 Derby before Ashin Murphy was even born. But in recent years, it's been harder for Saeed, with Charlie Appleby having the majority of the Godolphin stars. And I think for Godolphin, that was a big win yesterday to see Saeed back in the classic winner's enclosure. He spoke really well. And then, as you referenced early on, Ashin Murphy. He was really interesting after race, as he often is. He's a fantastic communicator. And you sense he's better than most people at talking about himself. And after race, maybe half an hour after race, I was chatting to him and asking him, in effect, how is he now? How are you doing? Because obviously we all know what struggles he's had. And he was talking about how he's actually now better at dealing with defeat and reverses. And he's had a few this year in internationally. Things didn't go well for him in Dubai or Saudi. But he talked about how he can now go home and look at the following day with positivity in a way that he maybe couldn't do when he was drinking. So I thought he was very insightful, Ashin Murphy. And Catherine, it was an important win for him because he's now got past that point of having a first major victory, at which point everybody has to ask him about what's gone before. I'm sure he's hoping now that we can just concentrate on the wins.
Yeah, I mean, I think from your discussion with him on, yesterday on Sunday, he's clearly gone through a lot of introspection. And he's changed the way he kind of goes about things. I know you spoke to him about he rides out more in the mornings as well now. And he's clearly got a point to prove this season, and he's gone out to try and make a statement. He got his first domestic group one group winner on Wednesday with Coltrane, and then straight away has gone and got his classic. I'm sure that's taken a lot of weight off his shoulders, and I think good for him. It'll do his confidence a lot of good. I know he's very happy to speak with the media, and that's always been a positive. But I'm sure there's some things he keeps himself, and there's probably a lot of pressure he's feeling on himself, and that I imagine would have alleviated a lot of that, and he can kind of power ahead. I'm sure he's got the title goals in mind. Him and William Buick were both at it in force, I think, four winners and three winners each over the past 2 days, and this is just as the season starts, so we could see a similar title battle play out a few months from now, who knows?
I think that's right, yeah. I think, Jonathan, that title showdown between William Buick and Ashim Murphy could be particularly interesting this year. Lewis Porteous is writing a column on that. Depending on when you watch this, that might already be available to read. Sobin Sura as well, though, we referenced him. That was a significant victory for Sobin Sura. Barely had any runners in Britain this year, but he is a classic winner again. For Godolphin, that will matter.
I think it will matter an awful lot because it's not like he hasn't been pulling his weight. He's been winning races, but just not to the same extent. And his reserve side is unfair, but Charlie Appleby is the first team, isn't he, as far as Godolphin goes. So it almost speaks to the relative quality that Godolphin have now, that almost their second trainer has a horse capable of winning the Guineas, when presumably the very best horses are naturally sent to Charlie Appleby, has first pick of those. And I was just really happy for him because he's, throughout the fairly lean period, he's always been fairly level and fairly good in speaking to the media. He's not somebody who gets too caught up in it. He's very loyal, I sense, to Godolphin and does still view it as a team game. And yeah, for Godolphin, they now have two trainers and two yards capable of winning those big races. So it speaks to their power, but it also speaks to the fact that Saeed Bin Saror, given the right horses, he hasn't forgotten how to train them.
Yep, certainly has not. Before we go into our second story, we have some news for you regarding free bets. Story number two this week is a story that appears on the front page of Monday's Racing Post, and it's regarding a serious situation at the Professional Jockeys Association. So the story so far, we learned in recent days that a number of jockeys had presented a petition to the PJA in which they were requesting there to be an extraordinary general meeting at which they would declare a vote of no confidence in the leadership of the PJA, and in particular the chief executive, Ian McMahon. Ian McMahon is someone who they feel has not been sufficiently visible during his relatively brief tenure as the PJA chief executive. But jockeys are also unhappy with a number of issues that have taken place in the last year or so, including where we are now with the sports whip rules. In response to the presentation of this petition, the PGA chair, John Holmes, resigned, as did fellow board members Simon Cox and former top jockey turned broadcaster Mick Fitzgerald. At the same time, jockeys are moving to bring back the former chief executive of the PGA, Paul Struthers, who now runs his own sports agency, and the previous PGA chair, Nigel Payne, in that Racing Post piece today, has described the situation at the PGA as one of an organisation in disarray, but made clear he would also come back if asked by jockeys. Jonathan, it's a really tough time for the PGA. For a long period, it looked as though it was, as Nigel says in the piece, the trade body that had its house in order. But in effect now, you've got a situation whereby the jockeys have mounted a coup against their own trade association. That's about as dramatic as it gets in racing politics.
Yeah, it is. And the PGA used to be my favourite of the acronyms because they... In Paul Struthers, they had somebody who was willing to kind of put his neck on the line, and he would fight for jockeys while at the same time he had this fairly intimate understanding of the machinations of racing governance. He understood how to get things done and the bureaucracy involved while also understanding the jockeys' need and this, the importance of being seen to be on the front foot and pushing what the jockeys are fighting for. Now, the PGA seems to have been on a bit of a downward trajectory for the last couple of years and has slightly gone a bit into hiding almost and a bit of a crisis of confidence in terms of speaking out on these issues. And that seems to be where the frustration has stemmed from, in that jockeys don't feel they're being represented in quite the right way with quite enough gusto on things like the whip rules, like the weight allowances and with valet pay and things like that. I think it's a building up of tension. Whether going back to the getting the old team back together is the right solution, I don't know, but it's a fairly perilous situation here whereby the board are frustrated with the jockeys, I sense, because they are many and various. They all have their own needs and things that they're fighting for, so it's difficult to represent 400 individuals at the best of times, I'd imagine, and they can, perhaps through no fault of their own, be a little bit late to speak out on things because they have their day-to-day, and it's easy to get caught up in that, and the big issues kind of happen around them, perhaps, is that from conversations I've had with jockeys. But at the same time, if you're a jockey and you don't feel like your trade body's representing you at what is a very pivotal time with the whip rules and everything else, I can see the frustration. So it seems to be, as I think Nigel Payne put it, a massive breakdown in communications between the two, and I just hope that there's a quick resolution to it, because it's a fairly turbulent time at the moment for jockeys, and they need to kind of get the house back in order.
Yeah, it really is a messy situation. I think, Catherine, the point that Jonathan raised there about perhaps there also being some dissatisfaction within the PGA leadership, past and present, is true there. It was made clear to me when I was writing the piece that the individuals who had resigned from the PGA board, John Holmes, Simon Cox, Mick Fitzgerald, there was a sense that they were resigning in exasperation, not necessarily because they were responding to the jockeys' request, but almost because at least some of them had reached a point where they felt representing the jockeys was no longer a viable option for them. I think there is a feeling within certain elements of the PGA that jockeys are not sufficiently engaged on key matters until it becomes too late to do anything. And although the jockeys, or some jockeys, are frustrated by how the whip negotiations went and the rules that we eventually arrived at, I know that there are people within the PGA hierarchy who have been frustrated that it's been hard to get jockeys engaged on that until it reached the point of almost no return. And historically, that has been, I think, an issue. And it is with, I think, a lot of trade associations in getting members to really read everything that needs to be read, follow everything that needs to be followed, because they are such busy people. And because they're such busy people, they have to delegate responsibility to a trade association. For trainers, that's the NTF. For jockeys, it's the PGA, and it's therefore imperative that they have confidence in that trade association. So it really is a two-way crisis. It might be jockeys presenting a petition against the leadership of the PGA, but clearly the members of the PGA hierarchy have got issues with the jockeys that they represent as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think Jonathan said quite effectively, it's a breakdown in communication. There's clearly... the jockeys do not feel represented and are kind of maybe circumventing going to the PGA. They're kind of speaking out to the media about the whip rules kind of at the 11th hour. There was clearly a breakdown in discussions there between the groups. You mentioned kind of a historical context. I'm kind of curious, as someone who's been in the sport a little longer than Jonathan and I, that's no comment on age or anything. Is this very unprecedented for between the PGA and jockeys, or has something like this happened before?
How does it compare? I think it's unprecedented to have reached this point. I mean, you will always hear grumblings because people grumble in any walk of life.
But
I think there's been such a build-up of individual issues. You had the fallout from changes to what was the COVID weight allowance. Mm-hmm. You've got the whip issue. You've got the sauna issue. You've got proposed new pay deal for valets and those who work for valets. I think they've all combined. And I think the thing that's driven it is this appointment of Ian McMahon, who I've got to be someone I don't know. I've had an email exchange with him, but I've never spoken to Ian McMahon. And I think the jockeys feel that he has lacked visibility. Paul Strellis, his predecessor, was always on the phone to jockeys. He was very prominent in the media as well, which I think...
That's part of it.
I think that is part of it, because jockeys see him on the media. Now, Dale Gibson, who is the number two, in effect, at the PGA, works incredibly hard, puts in enormously long hours, and still has been that direct link to jockeys. But I think a number of riders felt that Ian McMahon lacked that visibility that Paul Struthers had. And I think there is a feeling within jockeys that job has to be done by a racing insider. I think the problem is going to be that, knowing how dire things are within that whole setup at the moment, how many racing insiders will want to go for that role? They're pushing, or a number of riders are very keen for Paul Strellis to come back as chief executive. But when Paul left, he did cite the tolls that come with the job on himself. And he said here the toll taken on his family and personal life when he left. Now, that's not long ago. So presumably, if he is going to come back, he would want it to be on strict parameters that make the job more doable, because no job should take that sort of toll on an individual's life.
No, and it is a thankless job, but there are simple things that you need to get right that would make it easier. And we talk about a breakdown of communication. Well, from almost every conversation I've had with jockeys and from people on the other side, if you're trying to understand and represent the jockeys, you need to be around the jockeys and you need to understand the jockeys. And equally, because it's a two-way street and we're being balanced here, the jockeys have to engage if they're sent emails about big issues. That needs to be given due consideration. It's just about rebuilding the way that the PGA works with its members. And I'm sure that's been the case at various other trade bodies throughout history, where there's been this slight disconnect. But it's the easiest way to reconnect is to just get in a room and actually understand each other and have, you know, if you were chief executive, be in the weighing room, have weekly surveys of jockeys, it's effort at the end of the day. That's where my feeling from the people I've spoken to is there hasn't been that accountability. There hasn't been that engagement that they so enjoyed under, and perhaps slightly took advantage of under Struthers and indeed Nigel Payne.
Do you think the way to rebuild it is to bring back old people?
Wes, I understand the impulse. I completely understand the impulse, because Paul Struthers was always fantastic to deal with, and he was always, I think he, as I've mentioned before, he understood the challenges of taking these concerns and enacting change. He knew how the game works, but at the same time, he also understood the jockeys. Similarly, Nigel Payne has a very close relationship with the jockeys, which is good. I don't think this idea of it needs to be a racing insider, fresh perspective can be helpful. The fact that perhaps hasn't worked as planned this time doesn't mean it won't in the future. I just think they need to very quickly come up with a plan of how they're going to restructure and how they're going to take it forward more productively. I hope this is the watershed moment where the jockeys do start to engage, because they've realised what can happen if it's left too late.
I think we should be expecting a lot of things to happen this week. So we've already known the chair has gone and two other board members as well. I think we'd have to find out this week if this extraordinary general meeting will take place. If Ian McMahon does leave, perhaps it won't be necessary, but clearly things will have to happen over the coming days at the PGA. A lot is going to have to happen over the coming weeks, months, perhaps years, in terms of fallout from the gambling white paper, which was published not long ago. We discussed it in detail in the programme last week. But Jonathan Harding, again, things have happened, things have been said since then.
Yeah, absolutely. So everyone's still, I think, wrapping their head around the white paper and what it might mean for racing. Stuart Andrew, the minister, said it would have a minimal impact on British racing and did provide some figures that I think British racing feels slightly underestimate the damage that some of these measures might cause. I think people generally, with the frictionless or financial risk checks, as they're called, the two tiers, are thinking it's perhaps not as bad as it might have been and are just trying to work out how this might be carried out. That now is a situation we're in where we have all of these proposals, all of these recommendations, but we don't know when, how, if all of these various factors, they're going to be brought in. Now, the Gambling Commission has, the regulator of the industry has come out and given us something of a steer, suggesting that the consultation on many of these things will begin in the summer. They've been given more than 60 areas of work following this white paper, and it could be, we're talking years really until they're enacted. The key story of this week is that they've said in the meantime, things are unlikely to change. Now, that means we will be persisting with a regulatory environment that has led bookmakers to push for, or not push for, but to have to feel they have to carry out intrusive checks and requests for information for fear of fines from the Gambling Commission. Now, the Gambling Commission say they haven't mandated these checks, but there is this feeling that they've created an environment whereby bookmakers are carrying out these checks and pushing for information from punters and essentially carrying out de facto affordability checks ahead of the white paper. Now, that's a worry because that's already costing British racing tens of millions, and we're in a situation where nothing's changed, and we don't have a timeline for when it will change, so planning for the future is almost impossible.
Yes, I think a lot of people will be disappointed, won't they, Catherine, that the Gambling Commission has, in effect, said nothing changes for now, because we know how long the process could be to implement the proposals within the white paper. It's the start of a process, not the end of a process. And for punters and for bookmakers, that was pretty disappointing news from the Gambling Commission.
Yeah, I think a lot of people were hoping with the release of the white paper, there'd be clarity, everything would be sorted. But we are in a similar situation where we are still waiting for an indefinite amount of time for things to actually be enacted. And things are going to roughly stay the same. I mean, bookmakers are going to exercise caution while we still don't quite know how all these recommendations are actually going to play out in policy and in regulation. So there is a kind of degree of uncertainty that I think is just going to continue until at least next summer, possibly further. And we just have to wait and see how this plays out, I think.
Yeah, my hope is a little bit that the bookmakers have now at least been given a legislative steer in the absence of a sort of clear steer from the Gambling Commission preceding the white paper, where it was sort of this vague, you need financial checks, but we're not going to tell you how much. But also, if you get it wrong, then we're going to fine you hundreds of millions of pounds, this weird environment that we've had, and will persist. But hopefully, with at least the white paper's given an indication of what a proportionate threshold might be. Therefore, I would hope that the bookmakers will get their own house in order according to what is going to become legislation. But they will still have one eye on the Gambling Commission and making sure that they tread quite carefully.
And that's going to be, as we said, bad news for punters, bad news for bookmakers, but bad news for racing, British racing as well, because we already know racing's leaders have made clear how much money the sport is losing as a result of financial checks. The sport hopes to recoup some of that money through changes to the levy, which were referenced in the white paper. But another interesting development last week, Seb Butterworth, commercial director at Flutter, parent company of Skybet, Paddy Power and Betfair. He was talking about the reference to the levy in the white paper and also British Racing's desire for the levy to be changed on a number of fronts. The racing has been pushing for a move from a profits to a turnover based levy, and also for the levy to include bets placed by British punters on overseas races, as happens elsewhere. The white paper also spoke up just potentially just raising the threshold for levy so that the sport gets more money under the current system as well. And Seb Butterworth was very clear in saying that the sport has to be careful what it wishes for, because he was arguing that if bookmakers end up having to pay more money to the sport, that the bookmakers could in effect just change how much money they spend on other things such as promotion, on sponsorship, etc., etc. And we referenced in the programme last week that you could say that the white paper's publication was potentially the start point for a change in the relationship between racing and the gambling industry, which has tried to be very as one on the process to the white paper to present a united voice to government. But now there will be areas, and this is clearly one, where racing and the gambling industry might not be singing from the same hymn sheet, and almost certainly won't be.
No, this was quite an interesting bit of posturing, might not be the quite word, but
it might be the right word.
It was a kind of hold your horses moment, because levy reform has been viewed by some, I feel, as almost a silver bullet, and this might fix everything, and it's going to be a huge change, a sea change for racing's funding, and that may well be the case. But I think they're slightly empowered by its reference in the white paper. It was like, right, we're going to get levy reform, this is one positive, but actually for a major bookmaker or representative of a major bookmaker to just put the brakes on and say, well, just hold on a second, you're not going to get everything you want here. Actually, levy reform isn't, there will be knock-on effects of that. And he almost was suggesting, you know, we want to know where the money is going, how it's funding British racing, how it benefits us, and it's saying kind of get the product right first. It was interesting for me to read that and just see that actually racing might not have it all its own way when it comes to levy reform, and the almost threat's too strong, but the suggestion that if we suffer, you will suffer through lack of sponsorship and all the rest of it was quite interesting.
Yeah, I think we already knew that the process from the publication of the white paper was going to be long and probably quite painful. And I think that has been reinforced in recent days. Time then to decide who has the winning story in this week's show. Some might say that coup, revolt in the Professional Jockeys Association merits being the winning story, but as I said before in this programme, I carry through life a large guilt complex.
It is, though. I think it is the big story.
Do you think it is?
I hate to say it, but I think that probably is the big story. You're okay.
Well, in that case, you see, no revolt or coup here. My team members, although they've got very strong stories with the Great Guineas Weekend and the latest from the White Paper, have both forced me to make my story the winning story, and I gratefully accept. Thank you both. Thanks to them and to you, I also say that it would be a very lovely thing indeed if you downloaded the equally lovely Racing Post app. Then it for this week's show. Thanks for watching. I have been and still am Lee Mottershead. I say thanks to Jonathan Harding and Catherine McRae. We hope to see you next week, and until then, bye-bye.